This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week here at the Damage Report. It's a Monday, and Mondays are traditionally always very fun here, but I think this one is going to be particularly good. But let's get started off with the return of Francesca Fiorentini. Francesca, how's it going?
Salud, Dragon Squad. Happy continued endless birthday, John Iadarola. I'm sad I missed it.
There needs to be like at least a 2-week period where it's not my birthday, especially because within what less than 1 week, it's my wife's birthday. So let's make it about her for at least a couple days.
Sure.
I think that's fair. That's
then
a
back
fair
to
distribution.
You.
And then right back to me. But anyway, welcome back. I hear that you had a really gross episode of TBR.
Gross? Oh, no, no,
that's
no.
How that you was. Pitched it.
Oh, yes. No. So we're doing a top 10 later on, John, for all the subscribers of the Damage Report. I'll announce that. And we're talking about Mr. Lou Dobbs. And for a Newsbroke video, which there's a new Newsbroke out all about how to actually stop white supremacist and extremist violence, i.e., don't do another war on terror. But we talked about Lou Dobbs. So I think the reference you're saying is I was telling you about some what we called him, and we can tell all the subscribers exactly what we called him because it was pretty visceral and disgusting.
Yeah. And look, if Francesca's calling it disgusting based on our experience with her over the past few months, you know it's an issue.
How dare you?
But anyway, that sounds good. Okay, so look, we got a lot of news. We're gonna have a little bit of updates on the Senate trial, which I guess is happening soon. What's gonna happen with the COVID relief bill? We had some good news last week about that. So let's balance out the scales of the universe. A little bit of good news, bad news on COVID. It's a good news, bad news sort of day. And why wasn't Trump ever on Parler? It's an interesting question with a really corrupt answer, or potentially corrupt answer, coming up a little bit later on. But for those of you who are already watching, thank you for being here. Please hit the like button and share the stream if you haven't already. And if you'd like to engage with the chat over on Twitch, you know, with drawings of me shaped like a penis, or on YouTube, we can all have a lot of fun. You can send in messages, we'll respond as we go. And then after we're done, we're gonna do that top 10 list. So if you'd like to get access to that, it's available every week, as well as the back catalog, the ever growing back catalog of top 10 lists for our level 2 and level 3 subscribers or members over on YouTube. So that's all there for you. And with that, why don't we jump into this news? Donald Trump is the first president in history to be impeached twice, which means that it's the first time that you've been ever been able to sort of like learn lessons from the first one and apply them to the second one. Most presidents capped out at the first, so there was really no time for growth there. But apparently the Democrats do have some lessons. So what have they learned? Well, Democrats apparently complained that the first one was repetitive and sometimes sanctimonious, although it is the impeachment of the president. So if something was going to be, it seems like it'd be that. And now the prosecutors managing a second are prepared to conclude in as little as a week, forgo distracting witness fights and rely heavily on video, according to 6 different people working on the case. So pretty much everyone on the Democrat and Republican side wants this to be short, apparently. They all seem to agree on no witnesses, which seems really weird, Francesca. And we're gonna have a bunch of video, which we know the Republicans don't want. So this sort of first view of the strategy, what do you think?
I just think it's funny that like we're chalking up the reason that there was not a conviction in the Senate in the first impeachment to like, it was a little too long. You know, I feel like Republicans, they just couldn't focus. Like, no, they're a party of shook, cowardly loyalists. Like they are lemmings. They are like, and which is why we're in this moment where all of their complicity and their loyalism has led to this second impeachment that's actually put the lives of, nope, not regular citizens. Nope, no. That's been long been the case. No, of representatives and senators themselves. So now you see what happens when there are no consequences for your previous actions. So it is Now, do I think that that means that more Republicans are going to vote to impeach and convict? No. But I just think it's funny that there's like stupid hand wringing about like what didn't work the last time, as if like that was any part of any of it. Like it was a little, it was complicated. No, it wasn't. He just called up another country and was like, dig up dirt on my opponent. Bye.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great point. Because this article, like we don't have a bunch more from this particular article, but one thing they said was, you know, we want to make sure that we don't drag it out because then Republican senators could get bored or distracted. First of all, that's the saddest thing imaginable, that that's actually a consideration, but it's not actually a consideration. No Republican is like, yes, it is difficult, and though it might mean the end of my career, I must take a stand here at last against Donald Trump and his treachery. Oh, me get tired, me acquit. That's not what is gonna happen. It is an interesting, we could do hypotheticals on what might matter. Someone in the chat was like, he could stand up and say, yeah, I sent them to kill Pelosi. What are you gonna do about it? And they'd still acquit him. I don't know. I don't know about that. Maybe there's something he could say that would be a bridge too far. But there, how many open minds could there possibly be? I doubt 17. That's what I doubt.
And it's looking like he's actually going to testify. He's gonna be in his own hearing, obviously.
As of Friday, I had seen that his lawyers didn't want that. Anything could change. It's still possible. I'm sure the Dems would like it. Mm-hmm. I think, look, there's a lot of considerations on that. I mean, one, it was, that would be really entertaining, I'm sure.
I know.
And it really does bother me that he's never had to answer in any of these trials, or he didn't have to do like a big sit down with Mueller. Like we had the multi-year long investigation. And he was able to submit some written answers. That's it. Why doesn't he ever have to defend himself? This strong alpha man, the ultimate Eagle Patriot missile man. he just hides behind like, oh, I'll be over here with my lawyers. Because everybody knows that I'm such either a dunce or a liar that I would make things worse for me. So, and they're saying he tried to overthrow the government. That's what they're saying. So how could he not have to actually speak to that? How can it just be a thing where like, ah, we'll debate it. You just go over there, you do whatever you want, and we'll debate whether maybe you don't get to run again. I don't know, the whole thing, if you don't have him in, and I get that they can't apparently force it, it makes it seem less serious to me.
Yeah, oh, for sure. But there's nothing as unserious as Donald Trump trying to answer a question. So I don't know about that, but it would be fun to see him fire both of his lawyers live on television in the middle of the hearing as they're like, as they try to like calm him, you know, like it very like Giuliani to Melissa, what was her name? Calzone is what I'm gonna call her.
Calzone.
Calzone, and I can.
I don't know. You can, we both can. We have Italian privilege, so there you go.
It's Calzone. Oh, yeah. Carone. Now I'm remembering it.
I like Calzone better. Let's do that.
I like Calzone as well. Now I'm hungry. Damn it, John.
Good place for Calzones in Culver City. Anyway, yes. Look, it's ridiculous. Their whole defense is going to be that the Senate lacks jurisdiction to judge a former president after he left office because the Constitution doesn't explicitly say that it can, even though many of the people making that argument have supported hypothetically impeaching Democratic presidents afterward and have been perfectly fine with the same sort of procedure for non-president government officials. Like, I understand that it's a different level, but if you're saying that the lack of explicit authorization in the Constitution is enough for us to shut this down without even having a trial, then I think that that's an important bit of precedent that should definitely be considered.
Yeah. I want to just mention one other thing, which is about the lack of witnesses, which I just, it's a terrible idea. Like, I don't think that, I mean, unless they're going to like bring up AOC's Instagram lives, which are incredibly damning and very good evidence. Like why? Why not have witnesses? Why not have your fellow colleagues explain how they felt and how they were targeted, and have and because again, we know that not every senator or congressperson felt like they were in the crosshairs. I mean, unless your name was Mike Pence or Nancy Pelosi, Schumer or AOC or Ilhan, like we know who the targets were, right?
Yeah.
We know who could skirt underneath that. And the other thing I will say is that you gotta have Capitol Police and Capitol staff members who had to clean up, in some cases, feces and blood from the Capitol floors, from people's offices. These are people who day in and day out keep the halls clean, keep people safe, right? Like, why not hear from them? I think it would, yeah. I think it makes total sense. And today also is the first death of a sitting US congressperson of COVID. Yep. And we know that after the insurrection, there were people who tested positive for COVID. Now, I'm not linking his death to, you know, the possible outbreak of COVID, but we know that, like, not only did the insurrectionists try to, like, overturn a Democratic election, but also, like, spread a virus. But hey, what else is new for, you know, the MAGA crowd?
Yeah. Yeah, we mentioned that death on the pre-show. In terms of the timeline, he announced it on the 21st. Who knows? I mean, we have no idea. It's a tragedy regardless. And yet another sort of lethal threat that's being ignored by much of our government. What do the American people think about this Senate trial? Well, from the point of view of the Senate, nobody seems to care. But I think it's interesting to find out what the people actually want. There's a new poll, ABC News Ipsos, being described in all the headlines as a slim majority. I don't know, it's 56% of Americans back the conviction of Trump and barring him from running again. I guess 56 is a slim majority. It's America, 40% think anything. Like, you can find 40% of America that thinks literally anything you can come up with. So there's only ever 10% we're warring over. I feel like 6% is a pretty good chunk of that. But anyway, 56% are in favor of that. 9 in 10 Democrats back conviction and a ban. 8 in 10 Republicans oppose both. So hey, there's a little bit of bipartisanship. Some Republicans are in favor of that. And look, that's obviously, like, still a lot of support for Donald Trump, which is disconcerting. But you know, 1 to 2 in 10 Republicans supporting it is millions of Republicans, many of whom will have already voted for Donald Trump in that last election, possibly voted twice. They might own a red hat, and they do now think, yeah, conviction and a ban's not necessarily the worst idea. Some of those might be never Trump Republicans who are just sort of biding their time, but there are some Republicans, I think, a few. Who were convinced by what happened on the 6th and the defense of it afterward.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm tired of catering to, you know, trying to, like, morality whisper to the final MAGA holdouts. I know. We can't keep, like, you know, gauging our politics and our strategy based on who's gonna have a change of heart at 4 a.m., you know, when they're like, hey, maybe overthrowing a government's a bad idea. You know, like, no. Like, no, at a certain point, like, you know, I think we're far beyond the is this divisive moment. No, this is about what's right and wrong. This is about laying down a precedent. And this is about, like, making good on our constitutional amendment that says you should not give aid or comfort. There's a lot of comfort going on, let me tell you, between Trump and the many Republicans and those who planned the insurrection. Hey, let's look at the old Constitution.
So are you implying that saying I love you, you're very special, could be comfort? I've always found it to be comforting. My wife rarely is as complimentary towards me as he was towards the people that had already killed cops. But anyway, totally joking. She's the best. I love you. Thanks for watching. If you're watching, she's probably not watching. But if she is, love you. Thank you. Anyway, so let's see. The issue is that while 56% support it, you need 2/3 in the Senate. So that means you need all of the Democrats, which probably you could get all the Democrats, maybe. But you also need 17 Republicans, which is, like, you couldn't get 17 Republicans to join Democrats in, like, establishing nationwide factories to pump out Confederate statues. Like, they would not be that bipartisan on anything. But suppose, maybe we'll be surprised. I don't know. What are you willing to bet any money on 17 Republicans crossing over? I mean, they killed people, Francesca. It was serious.
No. Who would make that bet? No. Not after the election pool bet. when I was like, we're gonna sweep both houses. Shoe in. Here you go.
It's not great. I mean, look, we got the Senate though. Yay. Anyway, here's an interesting little tidbit from this poll. This isn't really directly related, but according to the poll, 42% of respondents said there were more radical extremists in the Republican Party compared with 32% who had said the same of the Democratic Party. Which, like, okay, so I get it. That's the hardcore Republicans are obviously gonna say the Democrats are crazier, but like, you guys believe in satanic sacrifices and stuff? Come on, man. We don't have anything like that. I don't know what that would look like on the left, what a version of that would be. I mean, I know that there are, like, you know, media personalities who believe some insane things, but there's no representatives anymore who believe such crazy things. It's just that sort of thing. I understand this is all opinion and people exist in their partisan bubbles. We're a tribal species and all of that, but that seems like that's a bridge too far. It should be a mental bridge too far for anyone, but. Anyway,
I just want to say, like, obviously 17 Republicans should not even on moral grounds, because once again, beyond like whispering to their you know, very, very underused moral muscle in the old heart, it's here in the soul piece. But 17 Republicans should vote to convict because what's why not? Here's the thing. They're calculating, oh no, we want the MAGA vote. Problem with the MAGA vote is it has nothing to do with you. It's not about you. It's about Trump. So if you want to get reelected, then you're just going to have to keep supporting Trump in whatever he does. And if that means that another insurrection, let's just play this all forward. Reelected, another couple more impeachments, five, I'm going to say, another insurrection, and then it's hang, insert your name. Like, that's all it leads to. It leads to step out of line and it's hang, insert your own name. So yeah. What is the incentive knowing that MAGA is so tied up with the Trump family? Not even, maybe Ivanka a little bit, but he would absolutely like push, like throw her off of a cliff, whatever he have to do, under a bus, over a train, all the things that you can stab someone in the back. If it meant that he could get ahead. So again, the calculation's ridiculous. Like, where do you want your party to actually go when we're watching it kind of disintegrate? I know there's people who are like, no, this is the future. It is Q. I don't know. I don't know.
I think it's what is it likely to be and what might actually work are obviously very different things. But to your point about, you know, what that vote actually represents, where it turns out, like, I get that. I'm gonna try to say something that pragmatically could be incorporated by a Republican to try to change their party in a way that might make them more likely to win, but that's not gonna work because they refuse to accept what has happened with the elections, and you're not gonna be able to learn anything if you refuse to accept what actually happened. But since Donald Trump got elected, they lost the House, they lost the presidency, they lost the Senate in Georgia. Maybe his movement ain't that great. Like, maybe it's not the best. Yes, they got some judges because of, you know, the way the Senate's set up and extra power to the rural states and all of that. But in terms of actual elections, they're not doing good and they haven't for years. I don't know, doubling down on that and going in the more satanic direction doesn't seem like the best idea. What do I know?
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
You must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We've given Joe Biden a little bit of credit for what he's pushed for in this COVID relief bill, but it ain't passed yet. And suddenly it's starting to look even worse than it did last week. Here he is on the inclusion of the hike to a $15 an hour minimum wage.
You also want to raise the minimum wage to $15. Is that something you would be willing to negotiate on in order to get Republican support?
Well, apparently that's not going to occur because of the rules of the United States Senate.
So you're saying the minimum wage won't be in this?
My guess is it will not be in it, but I do think that we should have a minimum wage stand by itself, $15 an hour, and work your way up to the 15. It doesn't have to be boom. And all the economics show if you do that, the whole economy rises. I'm prepared as President of the United States on a separate negotiation on minimum wage to work my way up from what it is now, which is pain. Look, no one should work 40 hours a week and live below the poverty wage. And if you're making less than $15 an hour, you're living below the poverty wage.
But that may not be in your American Rescue Plan.
No, I put it in, but I don't think it's going to survive.
Okay, so after that interview, which was Biden's first sort of sit down television interview, senior advisor to the president, Cedric Richmond, said Biden's comment on the increase not surviving, quote, was merely his prediction of what he thought the Senate would do, adding Bernie Sanders has assembled the team to make a very compelling argument that it should stay in the bill. We're going to go to Bernie in a sec, but Francesca, what do you think about this seeming preemptive retreat by Biden on the hike of minimum wage?
It's interesting because in that clip you see two different Bidens, which is like the one sort of like we can work our way up to it, and you know, it's not going to happen overnight, and it's kind of the politician's line that like whenever you're asked a question you always sort of retreat from the like principle of what you stand for. And then he just goes into like, wait a minute, no one working 40 hours a week should live below the poverty line. Yeah, wait a minute, that's what I believe. And it's like, and that's a little bit more of like the grandpa Biden, the Biden who's like, peace, I'm out, like I'm gonna just walk away. You like, I wanna like be the FDR. Like I'm not trying to give him that much credit. I'm just trying to see the moments where he actually just says what he believes. And then it's like, yeah, man, just say that. Just say people deserve $15 an hour now because they are living below the poverty line while working 40 hours a week. And $15 an hour really in a lot of places isn't even enough. So like, why not just stand by that? And then, but then he hedges immediately, but I don't think it's gonna pass. Who cares? You don't even need to say that. Just say, this is what I believe, this is what I want to get done. End of story.
Yeah, and look, in terms of saying it now when we're not there yet, maybe there's like a strategic element of, well, it's really looking like it's not gonna be possible, so I better start to make sure that people don't expect it, because if they go on expecting it for longer, then it doesn't happen, then they're gonna have a really negative response. Maybe. I mean, maybe think about that before you decide to include it in the first place. But I would also say, since we don't know yet and it's still possible, maybe put some pressure. Try to make it happen.
Yeah.
And it looks like it is possible. So we're gonna go to Bernie Sanders. Here he is talking about his continuing efforts behind the scenes to make sure that it is included and that it does pass.
We've got to raise that minimum wage to $15 an hour. And I can tell you, as chairman of the budget committee, we have a room full of lawyers working as hard as we can to make the case to the parliamentarian that in fact, raising the minimum wage will have significant budget implications and in fact should be consistent with reconciliation rules.
During the campaign, you were running for president and you said whoever you picked as VP would overrule the parliamentarian in order to pass legislation such as Medicare for All with just 51 votes. Should Vice President Harris do that, overrule the parliamentarian to keep the minimum wage increase in this bill?
Well, before we get to what the vice president is going to do, I got to get through the parliamentarian, and then I got to get 50 votes in support of raising that minimum wage to $15.
Okay, so we got two bits there, Francesca. First of all, he has this team of lawyers, which instantly for some reason makes me think of The Binders Full of Women, except that this one isn't misogynistic. But anyway, he's got people that are still working on it, so we don't know yet. So I would say project strength leading up to that. But then he didn't answer the question about whether Harris should overrule the parliamentarian. What did you think about that?
Well, I mean, then he answers it honestly, which I mean, Jake Tapper's assuming that there's 50 votes on the Democratic side. And the truth is there's not. The sad truth is they still have to whip those votes and make sure that all Democrats are on the side of a $15 minimum wage, which seems like such a no-brainer for us progressives and people, you know, on the left. But like, actually, there's the, you know, Manchins and Kristen Sinemas and Hickenloopers and other folks who were like duped by, you know, Joni Ernst in one of the first rounds of negotiations around the $1.9 trillion stimulus that were where they were like, yeah, no, we shouldn't have it, you know, and because they're whatever. They're worried about, I don't know what, small businesses that we keep touting out. So I think it's a little bit preemptive. I personally think if the votes are there, then yeah, Kamala should step in, my and one. But I don't know if they're there.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, it's depressing that you can get to the point where Joe Biden now talks about like the fact that so many people are effectively living beneath, I think he means the poverty line, but he keeps saying the poverty wage. But anyway, he now accepts it. He's talking as if he's Bernie Sanders, even though, you know, I don't think you have to go back that many years before he wouldn't have supported this either. But you still have people like Manchin who are like, no, if it's 11 here in West Virginia, that's the highest it should be anywhere. Because I have to imagine no place is more expensive to live in than West Virginia. It's an insane position to hold. God, Joe Manchin. Anyway, but I guess in this, I want to ask the question, is he going to be the one Democrat to end the doubling of the minimum wage nationally? And yeah, he probably would be okay with it, even though it would be devastating economically, the moral cost of the damage to so many families, including in his own state. But then also strategically for the Democrats, not delivering on that after making it a big issue is going to be devastating too. He seems perfectly willing to be the Democrat that ensures that. I also want to just quickly say, if you rewatch the first part where Bernie is talking about the minimum wage and how it needs to be raised and all of that, I get that he does a lot of interviews and maybe he's just tired or whatever. I was yawning during the pre-show because the coffee had kicked in. Jake Tapper looked so bored listening to Bernie talk about how the minimum wage needs to be raised and how people are suffering. He looked like he didn't give a damn about any of this. And I get part of it is probably because I assume he really despises Bernie Sanders. Maybe it's less the topic and more the man delivering the message. Look at him.
I think he's listening.
It's like if somebody was trying to talk to me about the Super Bowl right now. Be like, are you gonna
stop talking? He's got resting elitist face though. Like he can't help it, you know? He just has a little
Anyway. But we do have a little bit on Joe Manchin, something I was alluding to earlier. So here's that next bit.
Even if it makes it into the bill, you're going to need every Democrat on board. And West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin says he does not support increasing the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. He has suggested he could get behind a lower amount, such as $11 an hour, which I think is what the rate is in West Virginia. Would you be willing to compromise in order to get Manchin's vote?
Now, I strongly look, a $15 an hour minimum wage is not a radical idea. Making $600 a week in the United States of America, barely, you know, given the high cost of rent and all the other living expenses that people have to pay, that's not a lot of money. So these are debates that we're going to have within the Democratic caucus. But I hope and believe that at the end of the day, the members of the Democratic caucus understand that we do need to pass a $15 an hour.
It's just, I get that this is sort of how it works, but like the idea that like, Joe Manchin gets to decide if millions of minimum wage workers around the country get four extra dollars an hour or not.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, and this
sad
is
that like most of them wouldn't even end up knowing that it was him that might cause that. Like every day they work, they are noticeably taking home less money, potentially specifically because Joe Manchin doesn't give a damn.
I mean, look, can we go to the other side? Is there a Republican who believes that we should raise the minimum wage. I mean, I believe in working. I think bipartisanship is important when it comes to like bread and butter issues like this. But then you see the ways that the negotiations and all the amendments that Republicans in the Senate introduced to try and scale back any way they could this $1.9 trillion. And the fact that they are, and it's like, if we could just run ads over and over and over again in these red states about these senators and how they tried to cut into the deserved support of the for the American people at a time of an international pandemic, massive unemployment, healthcare crisis. Like, just come on. I don't know. I don't know what will work. But yeah, I mean, it is ridiculous that it would come down just to one guy. And I think West Virginians, they've been trying. They really, really have been mounting a good amount of resistance. I know there's a lot of progressives and Democrats who are really trying to change that state. So
yeah, imagine if everything else was the same, but it was Paula Jean Swearengin instead. The conversation we'd be having about minimum wage. All these elections matter. We still don't know exactly what the cutoff points for the stimulus checks are going to be. That's another area where now that we've moved into using reconciliation, this is purely the Democrats negotiating with themselves. But here is Bernie Sanders, who was on with Jake Tapper, talking about this debate they're having about where exactly the line should be drawn.
Where do you think the cutoff should be?
Well, I think what we have done in the past and what we have promised the American people, we've said two things. In the last month, we said we're going to get you $2,000, and that's $600 plus $1,400. And what we're going to do is say that everybody, a single person, individual, $75,000 or lower, and a couple of $150,000 or lower will be eligible for that full $2,000, $600 plus $1,400. Now, when people said we don't want rich people to get that benefit, I understand that. I agree. And what we need to do is have a strong cliff so it doesn't kind of spill over to people making $300,000. And that's what I support. And that's what I think most people understand. But to say to a worker in Vermont or California or any place else that if you're making, you know, $52,000 a year, you are too rich to get this help, the full benefit, I think that that's absurd. And it's also, from a political point of view, a little bit absurd that you would have under Trump these folks getting the benefit, but under Biden, who is fighting hard for the working class of this country, they would not get that full benefit.
Yeah, imagine setting up a situation where people had done better in regard to stimulus under Trump than the new administration, which wants to say that they're the ones who actually care. It's a really weird situation. I mean, let alone, you know, the fundamental issue where you are evaluating people's access to this money based on a financial situation that is like a year and a half old at this point and is not necessarily for millions of Americans at all representative of what they've experienced over the past year. Fundamentally flawed, and it's a terrible strategic as well as economic path to go down.
Yeah, I mean, but we love, especially in the media, I mean, like, it's always just haggling over like, but do rich people deserve the, like, why don't you just talk about the like the millions of people that have fallen into poverty since this pandemic began? Like, why don't you like bring a dose of what you do, which is, you know, actual journalism and reporting. That's you guys. Bring that into the conversation. And then we'll see that, yeah, $50,000 a year ain't that much. Let's like, let's, you know, like just throw in a cost of living stat. Hey, Jake, you know what I mean? Like, so that of course never enters. I just want to make another point. I am fascinated and tickled and so happy to see Bernie Sanders like on the front lines working on the progressive side of the Biden administration as the chairman of the Office of Budget or the Budget of Office or whatever the hell, budget chairman. The point is, it's crazy. Because first of all, he's a way better mouthpiece than Biden is himself. Obviously, he's lucid and cogent and like really he has morals that he knows exactly what he wants to say. And I just want to like hats off to all of the people the Bernie movement and a lot of the organizers that actually made for this moment and made sure that they were at the table. You know, obviously we have to see what is delivered, and obviously we have to see like how this goes, but it is just really heartening to feel like, I mean, first of all, the guy was serious when he said, not me, us, number one.
Yeah.
Look at him, he's fighting this fight, and it is thanks to a lot of grassroots pressure. And it shows that maybe, you know, that Biden knows that it was progressives and grassroots organizers that really delivered him this win. But just a side note, it's really nice to see Bernie in this role.
Yeah, no, exactly. Although, he does say the 1400 and 600 thing for the 2000. I mean, that like, just because obviously the sort of trust and affection I have for Bernie in comparison to other politicians, it makes me sort of think, well, if Bernie's convinced that they were saying that's what they were saying, maybe, but no, I mean, we've gone over all the evidence. They were saying $2,000. But anyway, that's the criticism. Other than that, it was a great appearance. It clearly really bothered Jake Tapper, but I'm glad that he's out there doing it, as he said. Okay, so a little bit of good news, bad news on the pandemic. Most of it bad because it's the pandemic. In addition to this morning, the first US representative passing away as a result of it, we do have some good news. And that is that the number of new daily coronavirus cases has dropped below 100,000 for the first time this year, according to data from Johns Hopkins. Just under 87,000 cases were recorded in the US on February 7th. The last time we recorded less than 100,000 was November 2nd, before the election. So look. 87,000 cases is still so much, but we've had a lot more than that recently. I mean, I still remember we were at 40,000, but it is starting to go down. Deaths are also down. 1,301 deaths were recorded on Sunday compared to 4,101 on previous Sundays. So those numbers are going down. They're still very high in comparison to sort of the middle months of the pandemic, but that's a little bit of good news, Francesca.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. Like, it's hard. The bleakest moment for now has passed. The real question is, can we remember that it's still dark in order to prevent another bleak and even bleaker moment? Because, like, once again, like, the vaccine is rolling out, but these are our uncles, man. I lost my uncle to COVID. These are our families. These are our friends. These are communities. Okay. Mm-hmm. These are people who are going to be, so like every life is really important right now. So I know it's hard to hold on, but put your stupid mask over your stupid face and, you know, try not to get your droplets everywhere. And yeah. Limit the time that you're like in stores and restaurants and grocery stores or whatever. Like, I just
totally. Yeah, and I know, so I see some people in the chat are like, well, but Sundays are always the lowest days. No, I get that. But that's why we're not comparing Sundays to last Friday. We're comparing Sundays to the previous Sundays. So it is actually trending down. We'll see. I mean, I didn't watch the Super Bowl, but I did see the crowds, the gigantic maskless Tampa Bay crowds. So that's not good.
And that's a lot of them were cardboard cutouts. It was an actual false flag Super Bowl. It was a...
Some of the flags were cardboard too. They were false.
The flags were false flags all over. But no, really, they were like cardboard cutouts. The people were still
I'm not talking about in a stadium. I'm talking about the parties like out on the streets and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
And they were happening in Florida, which is one of the places that one of the cool new mutant strains of the coronavirus is starting to spread. So here is the bad news. The more transmissible COVID-19 variant that originated in the UK is doubling here in the US every 10 days. This new study, which has not yet been peer reviewed, also found the variant to be up to 35 to 45% more transmissible than the COVID-19 strain that was first circulating in the US. And we have a statement from the authors saying, unless decisive and immediate public health action is taken, the increased transmission rate of these lineages and resultant higher effective reproduction number of SARS-CoV-2 will likely have devastating consequences to COVID-19 mortality and morbidity in the US in a few months. Decisive action is not immediately taken. And gathering in gigantic crowds for a fun, sporty event is not the sort of decisive action they're looking for. Now, before we chime in, based on the sample of positive tests sequenced in the study, the variant from the UK was detected in the US multiple times way back in November 2020, with two prominent groups detected in Florida and California. Cases in other states, including North Carolina, Georgia, and Texas, led researchers to believe that B.1.1.7 has likely been spreading throughout the country since late 2020. And most importantly of all, studies are still being conducted on how B.1.1.7 may impact the effectiveness of the two vaccines currently authorized in the US from Moderna and Pfizer. Another variant from South Africa called B.1.351, recently found in South Carolina, does appear to reduce vaccine efficacy, perhaps significantly, not only not protecting you necessarily from the worst effects of COVID, but also producing more mild and moderate cases, which the current vaccines for the original strain have been pretty good at limiting that. Mm. So a lot of bad news having to do with those mutant strains.
Yeah. The bottom line, when you take a look at the United States' strategy thus far, and even going forward, is that we are not serious about stopping COVID. We're not. We're just not, and we won't be so long as we're prioritizing making money over human lives, and so long as we are unable to pass something like a $1.9 trillion stimulus and bailout for the industries and the people who are dying and hurting the most. We in this country are obsessed with what we think is personal freedom. And at this point, that is the freedom to spread a virus and to die because of a virus. But hey, you were able to go to a Super Bowl party and man, go out like that, I guess. That's not the country I want to live in. I mean, honestly, you look at many other countries that have actually successfully, with far fewer resources than the United States has, that have successfully been able to contain the virus. And it has to do with a lot of like government oversight. It has to do with actually having a government that works. Part of that is limiting travel. We have 50 states. We have huge amounts of internal travel. I know people who have been traveling during this time. I'm not saying that they shouldn't travel, but hey, would it prevent the spread of these mutant viruses? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it would.
Can you, especially internationally?
Internationally, for sure. But even internally, if it meant that if we could contain the mutant strains to Florida and California, maybe that would be good. Maybe that would be good. But if we throw up our hands and say, no, well, you can't stop travel because that's our freedom. I don't know. Like, what are you gonna go stay indoors in the next state over? Like, I really want us to really consider like how unserious we are about stopping this virus, and yet how all of the answers are literally in our faces. They've been in our faces since the beginning of this.
Yeah, some of them have supposed to have been on our faces and we have rejected it.
Yes.
There was a politician, I forget the name, who was wearing a mask that said something like, I'm only wearing this because I have to or something. And it was a black mask with white text. And that mask was clearly in the photo over one of the KN95 masks. So like they were like, I'm only wearing this because I have to. But secretly, I also have the medical one under it because I don't want to get COVID, but I also really want to grift. So that's cool. So, if you are out there and you are curious about when you, assuming you live in the US, might have access to the vaccine, we've got some good news for you. But the good news comes with what's the opposite of a silver lining? There's some bad news too. Take a look at this.
Your op-ed today in the Wall Street Journal, I like, because it puts forth this tantalizing idea that soon we're gonna go from the current problem we have, where it's a whole problem of supply, too much demand, not enough supply. We'll have the reverse of that at some point where we have lots of vaccines and not enough people who want to take them. How quickly can we get to that point?
Yeah, I think it's going to happen all at once. I mean, this isn't going to be a gradual transition. And I think people are going to be surprised that it's going to happen sooner than we think. So if you look at the math, we're going to put about 220 million doses into the market by the end of March. And if J&J gets authorized, which I think they will, that'll be another 30, maybe 40 million doses. So figure 250 million doses by the end of March. And if a 60-40 split occurs, meaning 60% are first injections, 40% are second injections, which is probably about right, that's around 150 million people that will vaccinate between December and the end of March. I think that's going to work off a lot of the available demand. Then we're going to be putting another 100 million doses into the market in April. So I think once you're getting to those kinds of numbers, once you're looking at over, close to 200 million vaccines available for first injections, I think we're going to run out of demand. I think we're going to run out of demand sooner than we think. And I suspect that at some point in March, and certainly by the end of March, we're going to have to make this generally available. That doesn't mean everyone could go and get a vaccine on April 1st, but I think everyone's going to be able to go online and get an appointment sooner than we think. We'll still be rationing it through February, but at some point in March, states are going to have to make decisions about how to open this up more widely. And if we continue to ration it based on, you know, now more and more narrow slices of the population, it's going to get harder to administer. So I think we're just going to have to open this up to general availability, which is good news. I think certainly by April, this is going to be widely available.
They used the term good news several times there. And look, if you want to get the vaccine, the idea that demand is going to run out, so you'll be able to get it, you know, within a month and a half, maybe, that is good news. But if that's only possible because there's not enough people who want to get it, and they're just going to stay out there getting the disease, passing the disease, dying from the disease, passing the new variants of the disease, that's not like pure good news there. That's a nice side effect for some people as a result of the continued willful suffering of more people.
That whole clip like threw me for one, because he's next to, if I'm not wrong, like stock market value. So he's coming at this from a really cold hearted, like, you know, so, you know, you better sell off your Pfizer shares there because, you know, they're going to be running out. Like he's coming at it from a financial analyst perspective about how soon more people are going to be vaccinated and what will that mean for all the shares that you bought in Moderna. Like it's a little bit gross and or a lot of it gross. And so he then says at the very end, okay, that's good. Which it is good, but like, are they actually rationing it? Because you shouldn't be rationing it.
Well, they're rationing it now. Like in most states, you have to be above a certain age, a healthcare worker, that's the rationing they mean.
But
right
not
now,
because, but only because there is a lack. The production can't keep up with the administration. Please tell me it's only because of that.
And he could be wrong. Look, he might be wrong. It might be that they're sort of projecting what the demand will be. And they're doing this in part on some of the countries that have been more successful with vaccinating. So Israel is vaccinated a far higher percent. They're seeing a lowering of demand based on what I've read. But it's also possible that American views of vaccines are pretty distinct from most other countries, and that some people might be worried about it. But if we go a couple more months, and there's not widespread evidence of really bad negative reactions, if some of the mutant strains don't just overwhelm the vaccine, then maybe the demand will go up after that. So this is his prediction. It is interesting, I think worthy of discussion, but we don't know for sure that this is how it's gonna go.
Sure. No, and obviously, like, I mean, I'm not gonna talk about a national healthcare program because clearly we don't have that, but that would be one way to make sure people are vaccinated. You know, hey, free doctor's visit, free COVID vaccine. But for sure, you know, in lieu of that, partnerships with, you know, pharmacies, like whatever, Walgreens and Rite Aid, like getting your COVID vaccine there, that is what we wanna see. That is an affordable and or free vaccine. It should be free. It's free now. Let's hope it continues to be free. And also, like we've talked about on this show, the amount of countries that are not seeing the vaccine, and now we're talking about a glut. Like, I don't know.
That's true.
Like, what do we, if we don't want it, then to give it to another country.
Well, presumably that will happen. Maybe not immediately, but yeah, like I imagine some of these countries in India, like hearing like, oh, that we're just going to be sitting on 100 million doses that nobody wants is disgusting on top of disgusting. But anyway, see what happens. The best that Kevin McCarthy was willing to do with Representative Marjorie Greene, who used to be on committees but isn't anymore, that's awesome, was to have a little talk with her and supposedly ask her to apologize after all that she did. And it turns out that is exactly his approach to Liz Cheney who doesn't believe any of the Q stuff, but she just voted for Trump to be impeached. This is according to Axios, who says Kevin McCarthy tried to get Liz Cheney to apologize for how she handled her vote to impeach former President Trump before last week's highly anticipated House GOP conference meeting, a request she refused, apparently. McCarthy, who hesitated in the first place about holding a vote to oust Cheney, told her privately hours before the caucus meeting that their members wanted to hear she was sorry. He also suggested it could sway some of her opponents. Cheney's team, though, did a whip count, and she was confident she'd secure at least 142 votes, which she did. I just love the idea that they just want to hear that you're sorry for the thing you did. How juvenile of a way to approach this. But this is all Kevin McCarthy's got is private behind the scenes conversations asking, please just make this go away. I don't want to have to exercise any sort of actual leadership or like choice or anything. Just say you're sorry and let this go on. Let's move on from this. It's sort of sad.
Wait a minute, to kick her out of the which caucus, of the Freedom Caucus?
Were going to kick her out of leadership.
Just leadership generally?
Yeah. Of this and Girl
Scouts.
How
does it smell? No, I just want to know, how does it smell?
I don't want you to.
How does it smell to be that far up Donald Trump's crack? No. Seriously. Seriously. And how do you get farther? How do you actually wedge your whole face that far up the former president's crack? Like really though,
it's
you're so far up there that do you really, you need to get, you're just wedging.
Francesca, it depends on the resources you have. There's a very real fear of slipping out. So they have those little spikes that you can hammer in. You're gonna want to tie off every once in a while and use the buddy system. There are buddies in there and I'm gonna puke. Anyway, it's partly that. He's afraid of it. He's afraid of Trump. He's afraid of Trump fans. He's afraid of Marjorie Greene. He's afraid of QAnon fans. Who is Kevin McCarthy not afraid of right now, honestly?
Yeah, he's afraid of his own shadow. He's afraid of standing up for literally anything. I love when like your so-called leadership has no idea what they're doing. Like these are the limitations of like bipartisanship or getting along or whatever. It's like you're in Washington for so long, your brain just becomes like sort of mushy, go along to get along, and you don't stand for anything anymore. And he doesn't even know what he stands for. And it's a good moment because he doesn't even know what the Republican Party stands for. So it's almost like you don't really blame him because the Republican Party is like, well, we didn't have a plan after Trump. But what we know is that once again, no matter what, no matter how loyal you are, no matter how far you wedge yourself up there, it will always be at some point or another, hang, insert your name, chanted by a mob trying to overturn an election or shouting you down, because there's nothing you can do to be loyalist. There's nothing you can do you just can't. You can't. Yeah. So anyway.
You're always just hanging in there. But he'll shake you loose at some point.
You are a dingleberry. All these little dingleberries hanging off of Trump. And they think that they're a real person. They think no, you're a dingleberry. And he can cut you loose whenever he wants.
And then you'll just be stuck on a piece of paper to his shoe. Sometimes I think that participating will make it less bad for me, but it never actually works. Now, Cheney is not backing down on this, saying people have been lied to. President Trump for months leading up to January 6th spread the notion that the election had been stolen and people need to understand that. But bear in mind, the other side isn't really backing down either. The Wyoming Republican Party voted Saturday to censure her over the Trump impeachment vote. And I guarantee everyone, at least 95% of those who voted to censure her, believe that the single greatest threat facing America right now is cancel culture.
Oh, yeah.
But they censured her for daring to turn against their god emperor. Anyway, Liz Cheney, I'm perfectly happy to, in the very near future, move on from any defense of Liz Cheney. But in this particular case, the people opposing her are worse. Hello and welcome to the top 10 list for the week. The Lou Dobbs top 10 greatest hits from a certain perspective with me, John, and Francesca. How's it going, Francesca?
That's good. I'm super excited. I'm surprised that they cut him loose.
I know. He's apparently like their best rated show on, reminder, Fox Business. It's a business show he does. You might forget that because I don't know if he's ever talked about business on there. It's just boot like for an hour. But
who's the British guy who also who's like, I'm the British Barney, Blue Dobbs. Yeah.
Stuart
yeah.
Varney. Yeah.
Stuart Varney, yes.
Sort of talks about business.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's been fired. It was on my birthday. It was a nice present. Thank you, universe. Apparently it was because he didn't have a good relationship with his advertisers, even though he had great ratings. So can we maybe get rid of Tucker? I don't know. That makes it seem as if it might be possible, but I think there are limits to it. But anyway, we decided we are going to say goodbye to Lou Dobbs by looking back on 10 of his greatest hits. And this is going to be a combination of largely two sorts of things. Some of them are just legitimately awful positions he's had, quotes he said. And then there's a lot of just, my God, is he lodged deep inside of there. Like, I know there are people who are obsessed with politicians. Some people have said that perhaps I like Representative Ocasio-Cortez too much, and I get it. But I would say I've never said anything like any of these things. Wait until you see, I wasn't familiar with a lot of these. I had to do a bunch of research slash mostly use what Media Matters had put together. But I found a bunch of other ones too. So anyway, why don't we launch into this? Thank you, by the way, for being a level 2 or level 3 member on YouTube and making this available. We really enjoy doing this each week and we hope that you enjoy it as well. So at number 10, this is the first of the really sycophantish ones. So there are a lot of things that Lou Dobbs has credited to Donald Trump. There will be several on this list, but the first is when he credited the Trump presidency with an increase in Christmas displays and holiday joy. Not just that there's more displays, he has sensors that can detect an uptick in holiday joy.
There's more cheer. There is a quantifiable amount of cheer.
Cheeks are rosier. Garland glistens more. Tinsel, more tinsely.
There's more mistletoe. More people are being kissed under it. And none of those people are immigrants.
Yeah, he went on to say, my wife and I have never seen so many displays and so much obvious joy in the moment here as we come into Christmas. So it is to me, that's a pretty good measure. Animal spirits are breaking out in the best of ways. I don't know what that means. What? Animal spirits, that's like what I imagine like beaches in Ibiza are like animal spirits breaking out.
Breaking out.
Holiday joy.
Have more you seen cheer. Zootopia? That's exactly what I mean.
That's the sequel for it. So that's number 10. Now, number 9, let's go into some of the bad things that he said and done. This one might seem a bit subtle unless you're familiar with right-wing media. But back on September 11th, 2019, this is what he was talking about. He's talking about George Soros and he says, it is extraordinary and I think most people, I will include myself, cannot conceive of why George Soros would fund efforts that work against sovereignty, work against our laws. There are laws against illegal immigration. And to see his tentacles reach out into various non-government organizations and nonprofits that are working with everything from the Koch brothers to the Southern Poverty Law Center, as you document throughout this book, you had a guest on. It is stunning to see how pervasive and how successful he has been with his strategy. And so there are two bad things there. One is the idea of the ubiquitous Jewish billionaires' tentacles creeping into everything. And the other is that he's talking about him funding illegal immigration. That was the Tree of Life thing. That's what that terrorist thought. That's why they attacked a synagogue, is because they believe George Soros was bringing caravans in. Lou Dobbs is like, yeah, no, that's what he's doing. Matt, this one's a little bit more serious. And anti-Semitic.
You know, it's crazy, like not to do another plug, but Newsbroke did a video on George Soros and I encourage everyone to watch it. Matt Lieb did it and it was just, it goes into all the like conspiracy theories and basically like why the obsession. And it's just so funny that Lou Dobbs mentions the Koch brothers, because the Koch brothers are the same, like they're the same thing. The only difference is they give to right-wing causes. George Soros is just the only like, you know, mega millionaire, billionaire, whatever, how much ever much money he has, who gives to progressive causes. That's why they hate him.
Yeah.
And he's Jewish, right? So it's like, but like, it's the same thing. So you come back to like, oh, he's a billionaire who gives to his favorite causes and those favorite causes just happen to be ones that are like prison reform, you know, yeah. like Palestinian human rights and like stuff like that. And they are, but yeah, I mean, this has like actual ramifications, tentacles, man. I'm surprised he didn't start talking about his tail.
Exactly.
You know, his
yeah.
scales.
And by the way, I do not know a single progressive like media figure that's ever received a dollar from him. They really just do think, no, it's just you get, they found a get out of claims of anti-Semitism free card. They think. They think, oh wait, we're allowed to say this about George Soros, right? Okay, good. Okay. It's in the same way that like they desperately want to demonize against gay people, and they realize that that's a little bit harder to do, but they can talk about trans people in sports and in bathrooms. So it's like right. It's like their methadone, basically. It's like they get to do it. They don't get in as much trouble, even though we know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Now, number eight, another of the things that Lou Dobbs credits to Donald Trump. Take a look at this.
Have a great weekend. The president makes such a thing possible for us all. Good night from New York.
Oh, the weekend brought to you by Donald Trump.
The weekend.
Can we play that video again? You don't even have to have the audio.
Performing at the Super Bowl. I love how his makeup makes him look human, but he's definitely clearly been dead for 10 years. And he also has like very Gerber face. You know when like Gerber babies grow up, he kind of has like Gerber baby face.
Yeah. His eyes are so red. He didn't look alive.
Never figure out what color his hair should be.
He doesn't remember. He doesn't remember his original name or hair color. But anyway, The Weeknd, not brought to you by labor activists, brought to you by Donald Trump a couple of years ago. Did you know that in 2011 there were no weekends? Look at his dead little eyes and his hair color. Who are you kidding?
Yeah, anyway. Donald Trump makes it. I mean, now you're just reaching. Like, come on. You can't think of anything. Can you imagine? Like, remember when Trump like didn't know how to defend a second term for himself? He was like, I'm gray, yeah. You know? Yeah. He might as well have said just like, well, The Weeknd is back.
Yeah,
you know,
could have like, at least signed on to my call for a third date of The Weeknd.
Oh,
you can talk about that again. Anyway, okay, but lest you believe, I want to pop back and forth between the bootlickish and the serious, because he's not just a guy who likes Trump. You also have this. So this is way back. I think this might have been in like 2009 era, maybe a little bit after that. Yeah, no, because I think it might have been with the birther stuff. But anyway, here he is talking about race. This is back when he was on CNN, I think. Remember, he wasn't always on Fox. And he's talking about how you're not allowed to talk about race, and we should be free to express whatever thought we have about race. And take a look at the thought that he almost expresses before he dials it back.
And if any, and to hear a politician, whoever it may be, talk about how difficult it is to talk about race, well, the heck with them. We're living with the issue of race. We've got to be able to talk about it. And I can guarantee you this, not a single one of these cotton, yeah, these just ridiculous politicians should be the moderator on the issue.
Yep. Oh, by the way, he was talking about Condoleezza Rice there. I mean, he went a little bit broad and said, but that the conversation was about Condoleezza Rice. He was going to say cotton picking. That's what stop, he was.
Wait, the critique was about Condoleezza?
They had that was what he had been pitched to, is it was something about Condoleezza Rice and conversations about racism or something like that. And his whole point was we should be able to express anything about race we want. And he stopped himself because even Lou Dobbs realized that was a racism too far. Man.
Old Lou Dobbs getting woke. He's very like Jimmy Stewart in the year 2021, realizing what? We don't say that anymore? Oh, they can vote now. Well, that's a Christmas miracle, not included in my movie. Like, just so. Oh my God. Yeah. He was going to say cotton picking, which would have been probably the end of Lou then.
I don't know. He was on CNN. That's crazy. But anyway,
like, imagine thinking that structural racism doesn't exist and like thinking that everyone overplays it when like your go-to term is like cotton picking, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, oh, let me just.
I don't know if you're referencing a particular thing, but it didn't make it on the list. But he once said that claiming that racism was structural was itself racist.
Sure. Yeah.
That's the thing that he said. Anyway, okay, let's go back to the bootlicking. Here is some amazing detached from reality bootlicking about Trump.
No, history is written by the winners. And that means President Trump and the Republican Party that he leads will be the ones who decide. And it will be exoneration, and it will be century after century of veneration for this president.
Dude, come on, man. I know that, like, this is what your show is just competing with yourself every day to be more bootlicky about Trump. But, like, first of all, you get that he lost, and that he lost the House, and that he lost the Senate, and all of that. But centuries of veneration? In centuries, they're not going to remember anything. They're going to be like fighting over like the remnants of tin cans underwater because the tin can is the boat.
And being like, anyway, why didn't remember how Trump, you know, in this pivotal moment for climate change, did the exact opposite? Yeah. F that guy.
Centuries of veneration.
Like, what position, first of all, is he going to be the greeter in Mar-a-Lago? Hello. Welcome. May I take your bag? Thank you. Yes, thank you for this job. Praise him, Donald Trump. Like, he's totally the bellhop. He would look so good, a little bellhop. Like, literally, like, what is his position? What does he think his position is going to be? Other than, do you think he's the Messiah and, like, you're going to get a spot in heaven? Like, venerated for centuries?
Look, if you're being serious, what it is probably a primetime slot on Trump TV is probably what's going to happen, because he will do the show even more for an audience of one in that case. If not that, then yeah, he's probably going to be telling people that, like, there's a 3-for-1 deal on Stouffer's stovetop stuffing. This deal brought to you by Donald Trump. Anyway, it does get dark again, though.
Can I just mention, though, doesn't he also, speaking of child, like, he Gerber face? I'm telling you, he's got like child actor gets old face. Like, I feel like Haley Joel Osment is gonna look like him when he's older.
Don't you know,
where he's got like his face is small, but his head gets fatter.
Oh no, that's terrible. Okay, so at one point, just a few years ago, an ICE guard was trying to drive to the facility and there were protesters. And so the ICE guard thought, I'm just gonna drive right through these people. And this is how Lou Dobbs described that.
Just gladden your heart to see a bunch of demonstrators at a immigration customs enforcement facility blocking the path of a guard and then complaining about the fact that he sought to do what is within his rights, which is to proceed to park his vehicle and go to work.
He ran into a crowd of protesters.
What?
And they described it as within his rights. He gets to park. Doesn't it warm your heart that that happened? Look, he's bad in a lot. This is number 5, by the way. He's bad on a lot of different topics, but for a very long time, immigration has by far been the worst. This dude wishes they were like clubbing immigrants coming in like baby seals. Like, there is no end to how little he cares about the life or worth of people trying to get into America. The idea that even like protesters about immigration deserve to be run down by the police state.
Yeah.
Ugh, nasty.
Yeah, no, and this calls for what we called him on Newsbroke, which was I think it was pieces of Lou Dobbs, who, fun fact, is actually the stitched together flesh of every American's racist uncle that was then shimmied into a suit to hide the lightning scars that brought it to life. So he's
look at his rosy cheeks.
He's so gleeful in this. He is truly disgusting. And he's talking to, is this the acting head of ICE?
It was, yeah, yeah.
And like that, they're having this like gleeful moment of, I mean, and that really is like, it tells you all you need to know about ICE, which now is like trying to defy orders from Biden to stop deportations. They're a completely rogue agency that has way too much money, is completely, yeah, it's overfunded and it needs to be abolished, actually.
Yeah.
Anywho,
okay, let's go back to the bootlicking. So throughout the Trump administration, every once in a while, you'd get a book that was written or like an insider expose saying that like there were these factions fighting each other and nobody trusted each other. People were getting fired constantly, basically that the environment was terrible. And he couldn't have that. He doesn't want Trump, who's watching a show, to think that the White House sucks. So here is how he described the mood in the White House.
The demeanor of the folks working for this president, for the people. It couldn't be more positive. The mood in that White House couldn't be more high energy. I've seen a number of White Houses. I happen to have seen this one in its early days, and I have seen it now. And I want you to know the joint is hopping. At every level, on every floor, this White House is energized. There's sunshine beaming throughout the place and on almost every face. It's winner and winning center. And our White House, our
okay, it's winning center. There's sunlight beaming all over the place and on almost every face. Seriously, it's hard to get work done because it's just a glare. Like wherever I go, it's in my eyes. That's a joke. Maybe that should have been number one instead of number four. Everybody's high energy and they all have a smile on their face. It's like he's talking about Santa's village. He's talking about Stephen Miller skipping to go break up another immigrant family.
I'm getting a lot of like Scrooge McDuck going visit and visiting his younger self vibes when he's like, everyone was joyful and there she was. The dames were dancing and she looked at me from across the room. And that's when I had a heart. And like he knows exactly when America was great again. It's like when he was 13 and he like, you know, felt, you know, got his first little, you know, I don't know. Like he got a kiss from a girl.
That's better than what I thought you meant.
I didn't mean that. But like, can we just talk about how much this show phones it in? Not the damage report, but like Lou Dobbs' business. Like he's putting over his shoulder headlines like winning energy or and he's reading what's over his shoulder. Like
it's the same
script.
It's an
opinion. It's an opinion. It's the sentence that's on his prompter, and it's also the sentence that's next to him, which is not a news article or any kind of fact-based, you know, anything. It's just the words that someone wrote for him as an op-ed. Like,
can I do that? Can I do that?
Yeah, like imagine if all of the things you were going to say were also just the things over your shoulder that weren't news articles.
Yeah. It's so
and
weird.
Then you called that a show. I mean, look, it's cushy life, I guess.
He also said, and let's not pass this over, the joint is hopping. That was an actual quote from Lou Dobbs.
I'm telling you, you know, the joint was hopping, you know, and I put a little dime into the jukebox and there she was. Her name was Cheryl. She looked at me from across the room and oh boy, I felt my...
Stop.
Let my suspenders got immediately tighter, if you know what I mean.
No, not in a top 10 list. No. Okay, now we have three left and it's about to get dark. So and think about what you've
done. Oh my God, how long do we have to do this for?
I apologize. Only a little
no more. No more
Lou. This one's not fun, but I've got some fun ones. Anyway, number three is so he was being interviewed. This is back in 2011, I think. I ask a question and I'm attacked from the extreme left as a quote unquote birther. I mean, what the hell is that? When you can create a controversy by asking what seems to me still a perfectly common sense question. It's been used in the extreme left to create a toxicity that is just unbelievable. So years into the birther thing, he was still calling it, you're calling me a birther. By the way, it's totally common sense to believe that he's not actually a citizen. So he's like saying it's not fair and then doubling down on it again. Years into it, he was still a birther, saying that there is no way Barack Obama could possibly be the actual president. This is after they had made the documents available. He would never accept it, no matter what they did. If you created a DeLorean to travel through time and watch Barack Obama's mom give birth, he wouldn't believe that either.
Fake news. But that's the thing. Like, I mean, we forget. Like
news.
This is what happens, you know. We forget that like there was no apology on, well, definitely not on the originator, which is Trump, like his behalf. Zero apology for the birther conspiracy that which makes sense. Of course, Lou Dobbs is going to continue to like at least say that he believes in it. And people are probably going to still believe in it because there's been no apology, no like accountability. The people who believe it have been elected to office. And this is what happens when you don't stamp that stuff out.
Yeah.
I'm just like, and I feel like as Democrats, we kind of move on and we're like, okay, anyway, back to like, you know, especially centrist Democrats in the media, we're like, all right, we're refocusing because that's a weird thing. Yeah, but that weird thing still hasn't been debunked. It's still out there. So like, anyway.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. I have another instance of what you're talking about something still being out there potentially if we don't deal with it. And it has to do with Lou Dobbs's positions on coup d'etats, which it turns out, it really depends on who would be in power after it. Because back during the Mueller investigation, he said, they want to destroy this man. They want to subvert his administration. They would love to carry out an actual coup d'etat, which he supposedly, you might think, would be against. But after Trump lost the 2020 election, among many other things that he said, here are just a few of the highlights. He suggested that Republicans should just say, we're not going to accept the results of this election, no matter what happens. Demanded that Republicans surround Philadelphia and exert a demanding presence. When you're the Republican Party, they let you do it. Anyway, he defended the insurrectionists after January 6th, saying they were just walking between the rope lines. I don't know which part of beating a cop to death is just between the rope lines. And he said there would not be a quiet surrender if the election results aren't overturned.
So, I mean, I think
the coup thing is sort of, it depends, really.
I'm not going to give Fox News any kind of credit, but it definitely is a, it might be a sign. One, first of all, he is old as sin, but also he would have just kept on repeating the line that the election was stolen and that the insurrectionists had every reason to do what they did. Like, at what point? I don't think he would have walked that back ever. So, like, you kind of need some fresh meat in there if you're going to remake. I mean, because this is the interesting thing is like, if the entire Republican Party is trying to remake themselves and rethink themselves and their strategy and they don't know who they are, you don't think Fox News is also doing the same as their advertisers jump ship?
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out, yeah, what is their future? What do they believe
in?
They can't have this old, you know, geezer going on about the 2020 election.
Yeah, maybe. But they're also they're hurting, you know, because of OAN and Newsmax, and they just got rid of like the biggest Trump bootlicker on there, like maybe more than Sean Hannity. Like Sean Hannity loves Trump, talks to him constantly, but Sean Hannity hasn't done some of this stuff. So they're choosing a side potentially. But there is still one more, and this is another one of the bootlicky things. And this is just if you could summarize all of what Lou Dobbs eventually became. In one on-screen graphic, I think it would be this poll that they put up 5 days into the lockdown. How would you grade President Trump's leadership in the nation's fight against the Wuhan virus? Superb, great, or very good? I guess they can only put three, and neutral or bad just weren't options. So the worst rating you could give was very good for the performance against the Wuhan virus, for which now, a year later, almost nearly 500,000 Americans have died too.
What kind of college credit or just like passing third grade, like a couple stickers and maybe a lollipop were the producers at Lou Dobbs tonight paid with? Like, I feel like that's. Like, I always think about the people behind a show, you know, what kind of support do you have? Who's making your graphics? What, you know, it matters. It's a lot. And clearly, they were doing it for some like fun dips and, you know, a scratch sniff sticker. And like, cause there's, which, I mean, look, let's be real. That's why Trump ran for president, was mostly for, you know, I don't know, more access to Diet Coke and Big Macs. But like, there, that, by the way, that looks exactly like a Trump poll. If you've been on the Trump listservs, which if you've ever covered, you know, the conventions, they put you on them and then you can't get off forever and ever and ever. They will periodically send out these polls that are just like exactly that. The worst starts at magnificent.
Yeah, it's just a joke. I mean, that at least is almost like admitting it. like admitting what you're doing, like that your show just exists for like Fox, other Fox hosts exist for racist 70-year-olds to feel good and beautiful. This is like for racist 90-year-olds to feel like, yeah, I think he is superb. Thank you for pointing that out, Lou. And that's all it is.
Honestly, maybe like, he's losing his demographic, quite literally losing his demographic.
Every day he loses a bit more. The pandemic was rough on Lou Dobbs viewers. But like if we did a show like this for Bernie, with polls like that, and Bernie gave us the weekend, and when Elizabeth Warren walks into the room, sun shines in her eyes. Like, I really hope people would tune in for long to that.
It's very Grandpa Simpson vibe. It's like, I think it is, that is like, you're so right. It is the eldest demographic who the reason they couldn't put more options on the screen is because they couldn't read them. It was a stretch to like even put three. You can't make your audience have to put on their glasses, then you just lose them.
Look at his dead little eyes. Oh God. Anyway, Lou Dobbs, I would love to say we're sorry to see you go, but obviously we're not. That's it. I assume I won't think about you anymore. And you deserve far worse than this.
Yes.
Anyway, thanks, Francesca, for joining us on that. That was pretty fun, actually.
That was really fun. Thank you.
Great to have you here. Everyone, thank you for supporting the show and making top 10s like this possible. If you have requests for a top 10, feel free to post it in the comments to this video. Maybe we'll do a viewer request one next week. And until next time, thanks again. Very excited to welcome back to the program once again, public health expert, epidemiologist, and the author of the just released Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Very glad to have you back on. So I believe the last time you were on, it was more than a year ago. A lot's obviously happened since then. Your book has come out recently. It's about Medicare for All. And tell me, what was your focus in this book? And because obviously we're in an opportunity now where in theory, Medicare for All has become a little bit more likely than it was, you know, 6 months or a year ago. So what's the focus of the book? What's the objective?
John, you're absolutely right. I mean, most people have heard about Medicare for All in political circumstances. They've heard political backs and forths that don't really cut to the heart of the issue, which is that our healthcare system, despite being the most expensive in the world by far, with costs rising, putting 67% of all people who go through a personal bankruptcy into that bankruptcy, that we get mediocre outcomes at best. And our healthcare system was not able to deal with the crush of COVID-19. We have a responsibility to have this conversation and to talk about it in clear policy and more importantly in human terms. And so the book was about trying to take it out of the political and talk about it in the personal. What is it that people talk about at their kitchen table? What makes them fret? What are they worried about? And our healthcare system is frankly one of them. And we have an opportunity to rethink that. We ought to be doing it. This is the moment. And in this book was intended to be a conversation restarter for us about what we could do to build a more just, equitable, and sustainable healthcare system.
As you point out, obviously many people have been through medical bankruptcies. Even those who haven't, many feel like they're paying way too much for their healthcare. I'm curious, do you think it's gotten to the point where people understand that this isn't just a thing where they're going through rough times, that perhaps some of this is baked into the system of healthcare and health insurance that we have in America? Do they get that in theory, a lot of this could change with a switch over to something like Medicare for All?
I think folks are starting to pick that up. You know, the reality of it is in the past, when we talked about health reform, it was usually a conversation about how do we provide healthcare for lower income people? And that is a critical conversation and unto itself is a reason why we should change healthcare. But what's happening today is that even people who think that they are quote unquote sure, insured by the system, are finding that that system is failing for them. We profile a woman named Lisa Cardillo, who had the unfortunate circumstance of her husband having had a brain tumor 3 years before she had a freak form of cardiovascular disease that hit her at 36. And they are insured based on her husband's employer. And they were stuck in a situation where they had to have their friends and family throw a fundraiser for them to be able to just pay for the deductible, which of course is a paywall that health insurers put in front of the healthcare that you and your employer already paid for if you're lucky enough to have private health insurance through your employer. And so this is just not working for the median American. I mean, you look at the deductibles today, you're talking about the average deductible is about $3,655 for a family of four. And that family of four, the median family of four, is earning $69,000 a year. That means it's more than a full paycheck. We know that too many Americans just don't have that. And so it is a principal cause of bankruptcy. And it's not just low income people, it is people who thought that the system had been there for them. So it is stemming and building a conversation among all folks about what we need to do to actually take this on. And I believe deeply that if we are willing to come together to organize around building a healthcare system that we deserve, that we can get there. And I'm really quite confident of that. And I hope that this book is simply more fuel for this conversation.
Yeah, and hopefully the conversation will be happening now that Trump is out. We have Joe Biden, who has not personally, he's not a fan of switching over to Medicare for all. But we get Joe Biden at the same time that we're still in the midst of this pandemic that's claimed, you know, we're approaching 500,000 Americans who have died as a result of it. How does that change the calculus? Joe Biden says he's not interested in it. Is there still a path in the next 4 years that could possibly lead to Medicare for all being passed?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll never give up on a path. And you know, the point that you make is a really important one. It's that this discussion was litigated in the primary, which was largely something that took place in late 2019 and early 2020, just as COVID was starting to hit us. Now we have lived through this pandemic for a year. We account for 20% of all global deaths, despite accounting for only 4% of all people, meaning we're five times as likely to die of COVID-19 in America than the global average. And so this is a different moment. Our healthcare system was tried and tested and found wanting. And we have an opportunity to decide whether or not we think that tinkering around the edges of that healthcare system will solve it, or if we recognize the need to fundamentally take on the structure of the system itself and take on the health insurance industry, which is nothing more than a middleman that profiteers off of people's bodies, fights them for the healthcare that they already paid for, and does so in a way that accelerates the cost of healthcare. Now, look, I sat on the Biden-Sanders healthcare task force. And you know, I know that the Biden team was not running on Medicare for all. And we pushed them to a truly public option. We all know that that's not enough. But right now, we have a responsibility to solve the broken healthcare system as it stands. And so even if we don't get it under the Biden administration, I want folks to remember that you can kick a field goal and come back the next possession and score a touchdown. And we have to be committed, no matter what happens, to setting our eyes on the prize and being willing to continue to fight for Medicare for all, because that is the change that we need in this country.
Yeah, I mean, we know that when you poll people, it's obviously it's quite popular, even though the public defense or advocacy for it is relatively young, and there's far fewer voices in that than the constant attacks of it being a socialized takeover of health insurance and all of that. And not everybody opposes it for the same reason. Some people think it's communism come to America. You have Democrats who don't support it, but don't talk about it necessarily in those same terms. What do you think are the most important sources for opposition that we can potentially combat? Is it misinformation? Is it campaign finance from vested interests that would be ousted by a switch over to Medicare for all? What does the opposition look like, and what can we potentially do to fight back against it?
It is the coalition of healthcare corporations that benefit from the system as it stands today, and the way that they spend principally in two ways. Number one, fear mongering through legal disinformation about what Medicare for all would do in ad after ad that they spend millions of dollars pushing into our eyes. And then the second is the amount of money that they spend lobbying. In 2020 alone, right, in the year of the pandemic, the health insurance industry, let alone pharma, let alone the hospitals, health insurance spent $151 million lobbying across 845 lobbyists. There are nearly two lobbyists per member of Congress. That's why, right, the solution that seems to have some consensus around it for solving the unemployment and health insurance loss crisis, right, 15 million people who lost their health insurance because they lost their job, is through a COBRA subsidy. Now, here's the thing. Health insurance has never been more profitable than it is during a pandemic. Those health insurers didn't have to pay for elective procedures, and they lost lost coverage for the lowest income people, who also tend to be the sickest. So they made money in quarter two of 2020 alone. Anthem Healthcare doubled its profits versus 2019. And they've spent that money to go and double dip in the midst of this pandemic, asking that the American taxpayer, in effect, give them money to do the thing they should have done, which is keep those folks on their health insurance in the first place. And so, you know, those two issues, the way that they can spend to try and fear monger to the American public, and the way they can spend to reshape public policy in their own interest, that really has to be what we take on. In the book, we have a chapter called Organizing versus Advertising, right? They're going to keep advertising, they're going to keep fear mongering. There's not much going to change about that. But what could change is that when all of us come together and realize that we are all in this thing together, none of us get the healthcare that we deserve in this country simply because of the way that the system works, that we come together and we build common cause and we take them on. It is our vote in the end that matters most for these politicians, and we've got to make it matter.
Yeah, and to that point, you said it would sort of been litigated a little bit in the primary. People should bear that in mind. Get involved in these primaries early, and potentially we could have a candidate who would champion it. The book is Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide, but I know that you've also recently launched a newsletter. Could you tell us about that?
That's right, it's called The Incision. And the hope was to take some of the momentum from this book and my last book, Healing Politics, and create a space to develop some of these ideas. In fact, I hope folks will sign up tomorrow. We're dropping an article really laying out the way that the health insurance industry is trying to double dip in the midst of this pandemic. And really want for folks to understand that once you cut through the surface level, you really do see the way that money and power tend to wrap themselves around many aspects of our lives. And so talking a lot about healthcare, but also talking a bit more about the way that race gets in the way when it comes to public policy, about our education system, and about the way that we consume and produce information. So I hope folks will check it out. It's incision.substack.com.
Awesome. Dr. Abdul El Sayed, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for keeping the drive alive. We've got to win the future for Medicare for All.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.